This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and this show is called The People Behind the PhDs. This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome back to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Steve Prismas, who studies translanguaging and bilingual education at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas. That's near Dallas. There's an overlap of about 10 seconds. We can pick up right where we left off in The People Behind the PhDs.
And so I'm advising students all the time, and I have begun to share that story that, you know, where I came from, who I was, didn't ever match up to where I'm at now. So at certain points along the way, I had to take risks, you know, and do things that made me a little uncomfortable, but they almost always paid off.
So just so everyone knows, if you wondered about the story that Steve is talking about, it's called imposter syndrome. So every first year PhD student knows this very, very well, probably some master students as well. And it's basically this psychological feeling that the individual doubts their accomplishments or their abilities to, you know, work in a what they consider a very high-end thing. It could be academics, it could be something very hard military, it could be some corporate thing, it could be lots of different things. But what Steve's kind of talking about is the imposter syndrome. So if you are thinking about doing a PhD someday or a higher education degree someday, if you have this feeling of being an imposter, it's very normal and very natural, and evidence number one from that is this really incredible professor now at Texas Christian University who actually feels still the imposter syndrome. So just I want to give people a sense of what Steve's talking about. So Steve, you were, when we last were moving sequentially through this conversation, you were talking about University of Arizona. So tell us about that experience for you and what experiences you had that eventually led you to this translingualism, because that's what your focus is now.
Right. I think that the strength of the program at the University of Arizona is it's very, very interdisciplinary. So,
what's the name of it?
Second Language Acquisition and Teaching. So the interdisciplinary PhD program in SLAT. And I forget how many departments, but I think it's something like 17 or 18 different academic departments across campus. SLAT students can take classes in. So, you know, if I look on my transcript, I took classes in anthropology and in linguistics and in modern languages and in the College of Education, and you know, it's kind of all over. And what that was great for me is I've never been short of ideas. You know, when I talk about this imposter syndrome, it's always been, you know, can I tell my ideas in a way that other people will see as professional or academic, or you know, is my writing good enough? Is my, you know, but I have lots of ideas, and I always have, you know, that young boy walking the town, you know, I've got a million ideas. So the PhD program was great because I would hear people in anthropology talk about things, and I'd hear people in linguistics talk about things, and even within linguistics, psycholinguistics, cognitive linguistics, sociolinguistics, and then I'd go to classes at the College of Education, and people would be talking about the same things, but in a much more practical, in the classroom, rubber hits the road kind of way, and you know it was just great for me. But what I started, I've always, you know, used language as a way to understand the world, and to understand the identity of people in the world. And I think an interdisciplinary approach like this, you know, makes one come to the conclusion that language is not a, it's not, there's not a dichotomy of it's either this or that. It's everything. It's the clothes you put on. It's the space between two people that are talking. It's the way a classroom's organized. You know, it's very, very multimodal. And then so if you take that then into communication, we have in our, at least in the United States, a propensity to hear someone talk and say, they're talking that language. And then when they use another language, we say they're talking that language. And I recognize those to be different languages. But there's nothing inherently specific about, or nothing inherently different about the features of Spanish that make them Spanish. People have done that. So languages are socially constructed from people over time. And from the outsider's perspective, this makes sense. You hear someone and they sound like they're using different named languages, but inside a person's brain is just language and their collection of linguistic features that they've gathered across a lifetime of lived experiences. So I think this interdisciplinary approach, to come full circle, this interdisciplinary approach of hearing how people talk about ideas across fields led me to look at that specifically with languages and how people collect linguistic features like they collect ideas, and then they have that in their repertoire to use. So translanguaging, it's a verb. It's just a languaging with all of the linguistic features that you have at your disposal.
Categorization. That's one of the big ideas Dr. Prismas is touching on. To categorize is to arrange in groups, and it is both a cognitive and social concept. Our brains distinguish sounds from visual stimuli, and in our lives as humans, we distinguish groups of things, people, places, and sounds. Sounds, accents, dialects, languages. Think about your own life and how you categorize things. Is it a cognitive or social distinction?
Whether they come from a named language that you call German and a named language I call English, they're just in someone's head.
Okay, so you view language as, that's great. Thanks, Steve. So you view language in a very expansive definition. We'll use that term for now. Could you put, could you share a little bit about your research you did while you're at University of Arizona called the Subliminal Influence of Street Signs? Because I think that's a nice concrete way to share with people who don't know some of your research what you mean by some of the translanguaging conversation you just had. So can you share a little bit about that research?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just begin by saying we are products of our environment, but we're also developers of our environment. So we... We are influenced every day by the linguistic landscape. Messages on billboards, shop signs, street signs. And then, of course, we also produce those intentionally. So my interest is somewhere in the middle. It's, of course, what decisions people intentionally do. What language are you going to put on this street sign and why? What's the decision behind there? And then what's the... You know, what's it mean? What's the message that is given to the world when you decide to put that on there? And then implicitly, how are people who experience that sign, driving by it in a car, on a bicycle, walking by it, how does it impact their view of the world? How does it impact their view of languages? And default, how does it have an impact on the people who speak those languages? So Tucson's an interesting place. It's 60 miles north of the Mexico-U.S. border. Historically, it was Mexico before the Gadsden Purchase.
The Gadsden Purchase refers to land that the United States purchased from Mexico in 1854. The land is in present-day southern Arizona and southwest New Mexico. It was the last purchase of the contiguous connected 48 American states. Mexico sold it for $10 million, which would be $230 million in 2018.
Purchase. So you've got very traditional, historic Mexican-American families that have been there for a long, long time. And some research that I've done on my own, and then research I did with Dr. Alan Kohler, was taking a look throughout history at the language of street signs in the city of Tucson to see if we can kind of make some points about the influence of our surroundings on our ideologies, and then decisions that are made for kids at school. Street signs are interesting to look at, because if you ask someone, is a street sign a private thing or a government thing, most people will say it's government, like the city did it. But they're actually pretty private. Some developer can say, I'm going to put a street in here and I'm going to name it this. Now, of course, there's some kind of application, some kind of right that the city grants them to do this, all the things you need to do to develop a neighborhood. But understanding that means that throughout time, people have named streets for some reason or another, and they've also changed. So historically, there were many streets in Tucson that had Spanish words, Spanish surnames, that were changed to English, largely in the 1930s.
Can you remember any examples of that, how they were words, street names that were changed from one to the other?
Well, if you look at downtown Tucson, the major streets that go through the center of town, there may be one or two that are in Spanish today, and I don't have it in front of me, and I'm starting to forget some of the names the longer I live away from it, but they were changed. So there used to be a part of downtown called La Calle, the street, and La Calle was a very important part of Tucson. It was kind of known. You think about a Mexican city, if you've ever been to a Mexican city where there's these centers of towns and these big plazas, La Calle was kind of like that. It was a major important part of town, and it was taken away in order to build the convention center that's there now. And so a lot of houses were replaced, a lot of people were replaced, and a lot of street signs were changed. And gosh, Zach, you know those streets better than me right now. If you think of a street that's in English, but I know there are some there, like Toole, you know, T-O-O-L-E. Another example is in Sunnyside, which is a school district in South Tucson. 90-some percent Hispanic. Over 60% of the people claim Spanish to be their first language at home. But we know from research, it's probably even higher than that. But a lot of people won't always claim it to be their first language for political reasons and things. But in the 1930s, a very, very specific initiative was conducted in the city of Tucson to Americanize that part of town. Street signs were changed from Spanish to American states. So if you go to that part of Tucson, there are 26 U.S. states on street signs. Nebraska, Iowa, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Michigan, and U.S. military generals like MacArthur and things like that. And they even branded the community. They called it, it's escaping me right now. What was the name of it? It's in that article. It's a really interesting. National City. That's what it was called.
Wow.
National City. And they had flyers that said, here is your chance, an opportunity. Of course, we all know what that chance or opportunity is to become American. At the same time, or by default, English speakers, by the same time, about 20 years later in the 1950s, the town started expanding north towards the Catalina Mountains, and which is now today the foothills, the Catalina foothills. And over 76%, close to 80% of the 500 street signs in that part of town are Spanish words, yet fewer than 6% of the people that live in that neighborhood speak Spanish.
So just to summarize, so in the south part of Tucson, where there's more Spanish speakers and Hispanic origin, Mexican origin people, there's more street signs in English. In the north part of Tucson, where there's more Anglo and fewer Hispanic speakers, there's more street signs in Spanish. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And then, just to take this to a very practical rubber hits the road ending, in the south of Tucson, the Spanish language is prohibited to be used in schools. Only students who have an IEP, an individualized education program, where it states they can use Spanish, only those kids are the ones that can use Spanish in schools. So it's English only. But in the north, in the Catalina Foothills School District, there are several dual language programs where Spanish is encouraged for kids to become bilingual.
This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com. As a person who doesn't know your research, it just sounds very bizarre.
Yeah. And it's not just to Tucson. You can go to neighborhoods in San Diego. You can go to neighborhoods in Albuquerque. There's a brand new neighborhood in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex that is primarily white, English-speaking, affluent, and gated community called La Frontera, which is the border. And living in Arizona, living in Texas, it's a palpable feeling to talk about the border and how contentious it is, and whether a wall is going to be built or the existing wall is going to be bigger or higher or tougher, and you know, all of those things. So for this privileged community to name their gated housing community La Frontera is striking.
Now, kind of bring us back to Texas. So you graduated University of Arizona and then got a job as an assistant professor at Texas Christian University. And your focus is on translingualism. Can you maybe give us and you've talked a lot about translingualism already. Can you give us just a clear definition of translingualism and the research you're taking with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the use of more than one language has had many names over the years, code switching, code mixing, code meshing, Spanglish, and what I call translinguaging, what others have called translinguaging, doesn't describe anything different than those. Si empiezo una oración en español and I finish it in English, call it what you want. But just understand that what you call it does have an impact on how people view it. So I am heavily influenced by Richard Ruiz and his work and language orientations, and language is a problem, language is a resource, and language is a right. And even people who advocate for that kind of languaging as a resource, if they call it code switching, what they're doing is they're tapping into people's deficit frames of switching between different linguistic codes, almost as if bilinguals have two monolinguals in their brain. That's problematic because then you can judge. You can say, well, you're not so good at Spanish or you're not so good at English. And newsflash, a lot of kids might get judged as not being so good at anything. You know, which causes them to be viewed as an identity as a problem. So
does that really happen, Steve? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but does it really happen that, you know, a group of all Spanish speakers would judge a bilingual Spanish-English speaker as less than? And is it also true that English speakers judge a bilingual who speaks Spanish or English as a second language as less than? Is that really true that both of those communities could judge a person similarly? In that case, similarly bad?
It absolutely does. So before this call with you, I gave a 90-minute talk at a conference here in Fort Worth, and the conference is called the Conference for the Education of Hispanics. And a lot of examples that came up were of teachers saying, well, they're Spanish, and they're talking about their kids, isn't as good as mine. It's not, you know, it's not proper Spanish or however. And, you know, so we talk through like, okay, not everyone's the same. If you just judge them or assess them on their Spanish, realize they've had different lived experiences. They know a lot in English as well. And not only do they know a lot in English, but they know a lot when allowed to use both languages at the same time, or translanguaging. So there's kind of where this really is important is assessing kids. And we know about the disproportionality of emergent bilinguals in special education. Disproportionality means that they're both underrepresented and overrepresented. So typically they are overrepresented in special education in school districts where there are under 100 emergent bilinguals in the whole school district. And they're underrepresented in special education school districts where there are over 100 emergent bilinguals. So in Texas, they're very, very, very much underrepresented. 7.3% of emergent bilinguals are in special education, and 13% of kids in general are in special education. So they're clearly underrepresented. So where translanguaging comes in is it teaches us kind of the importance of assessing kids with their whole linguistic repertoire.
While we are listening to the interview with Dr. Prisness, we should understand the distinctions among testing, evaluation, and assessment. Testing is used to test someone's knowledge or skill of a particular topic and then assign a score. Evaluation is the process of making judgments about tests based on criteria, let's say school district standards. Assessment is the process of documenting knowledge in measurable terms. The goal of assessment is to make improvements and not just judge a person on a scale.
The repertoire. If we assess someone all in Spanish and then we assess them all in English, that's not bilingual. We've just monolingually assessed them in one language and monolingually assessed them in another. So a huge part of my research is looking at ways to develop ways to assess, evaluate, place, and instruct students using their whole linguistic repertoire.
So what is the problem of assessing, I'm kind of talking as a critic, what's the problem of assessing people in Spanish and then in English?
Well, because we learn content throughout our lives, and if I'm just assessed in Spanish, I may be able to talk about that content and show my knowledge, show my ability, show my identity, but I'm limited. I may also know how to talk about that content and in meaningful ways in English.
I see.
But if you just assess me in English and don't allow me to use my Spanish, then I'm also limited.
So the assessment tools we're taking towards this group of students and people are limited. That's kind of what you're saying, is that they don't capture all of the intelligence and linguistic knowledge a person has.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And there are ways to capture that. If we rely on just current traditional standardized tests, they're going to be normed on monolinguals, either normed on monolingual English speakers or normed on monolingual Spanish speakers. So we need to develop or use existing standardized tests that allow for the flexibility of translanguaging, which you can do. Language sample analysis of story retells that are attached to content are a tremendous way to get a snapshot of a student's ability bilingually. Telling stories requires someone to talk about the context, the participants, the problem, the resolution, the setting, and it's a much more complex sample of language than just a conversation or expository talk or something like that.
Wow.
So we do that. I currently do it with a school called the International Newcomers Academy here in Fort Worth. There's 37 different languages at the International Newcomers Academy. And we bring in interpreters, if it's Farsi or Urdu or it's whatever, and we have students retell a story linked to content, and we give them the freedom to tell it using their whole linguistic repertoire. We record it, we transcribe it, we upload it to the Systematic Analysis of Language Transcripts, or SALT software, which gives us quantitative data on their language ability.
That's fantastic. So it sounds like you're working a lot with the school districts locally.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, I have several projects going on with local school districts, and then I also give training to bilingual educators on translanguaging and assessment.
Yeah, so if we go back to the early part of your your interview, you walked around a lot, you know, imagining all these, having all these ideas. You taught in junior high, and even though you eventually sort of got into academia, you sort of always wanted to bring it back to a very practical thing. You shared at University of Arizona, you were taking anthropology classes, and when you went to the education classes, then suddenly you were thinking about how you can actually use all these, you know, lofty ideas into very practical applications. It sounds like a lot of who you have been in your life is continuing, but just in a different format. Is that, do you think, accurate if you had to summarize Dr. Prismas?
I think that is accurate. And I think I will just say something related to that, that I did come into academia a little later than some people do. I was 41 when I, 42 when I finished my PhD. And I think
ancient.
That... I'm sorry?
Ancient, right?
Yeah, right. I just think that I approach what I do from always a, am I passionate about this first? Is this going to make me want to get up in the morning first? And then secondary is, am I able to publish about this? Or do I actually have time to do this? Or however. And for me, that's a really liberating way to look at it. As a pre-tenured faculty, I don't know how that'll work out for me.
Yeah.
But, you know, because you have to publish enough to get tenure, and you have to do all those things, service and get good. Fortunately, I've always been a strong teacher. I love teaching, so I get good evals from my students, which is a part of my evaluation overall. But I think that you're right. I think that the ideas I've had from a really young age, that, you know, the things that I felt as a Peace Corps volunteer, things I've felt living in other countries, I'm able to now, and perhaps because of the three letters after my name, have a little bit more influence about those things when I talk with people, and that's really gratifying to me.
Great. So this one final thing for this last part of the show. Random thought. So I'm going to list four famous Steves, and I want you to tell me which of these four Steves you are most like. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, so Steve Jobs, he's a famous entrepreneur. You might have heard of him. Steve Harvey, he's a comedian, pretty funny guy, for sure. Steve Irwin, he's passed on now, but he was the guy who would open alligators' mouths and be excited about animals, especially in Australia. And Steve Perry, rock singer. So of those four famous Steves, which Steve are you most like? Steve Jobs, the entrepreneur? Steve Harvey, the comedian? Steve Irwin, the reality star? Or Steve Perry, the rock singer?
The first one, who was it again?
Steve Jobs.
Yeah, Steve Jobs. Just because I have a lot of ideas, and it's going to be hard sometimes, I think, to get those ideas accepted or to kind of convince people of those ideas, but I think it's always going to be worth it in the end.
Thanks for listening to the three-part interview with Dr. Steve Prismas, who studies translanguaging and bilingual education at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, near Dallas, Texas. Check out more Dr. Z podcasts at drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at DRZ Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding. The People Behind the PhDs is conceived, written, produced, and edited by Dr. Z, that's me, Zachary Brooks, PhD, in Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts. Learn more at drz.net/about, that's dr-z.net/about.